And now it's time for On Our Minds. Do you ever worry that it's getting harder to keep up with your computer? Well, this week we've been thinking about the future of computing. Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom has a new book out called Superintelligence. And in it, he imagines what would happen if computers were to become smarter than humans. He tells Steve Paulson it could be disastrous, unless we start thinking about it now.
So just as we have machines already that can perform various other functions more efficiently than biology, like there's bulldozers is like a stronger muscle. We have like loudspeakers that can shout louder than a human lung. And so eventually this other function of biology, the brain function of smartness, I think will also be exceeded in machines.
Well, let's consider what this scenario might look like. Okay, let's just hypothetically say that super intelligent machines do arise at some point in the future. What does the world look like at that point?
Hopefully, one thing that will be different is that by that time, there will have been more work done the control problem, how to ensure that the outcome of that intelligence is safe and beneficial, which is a huge unsolved problem. That's sort of what my book is really about. So if it were to happen today, we'd probably be doomed.
Doomed because you're assuming that the superintelligence would want to get rid of humans. Why?
Yeah. So hopefully they won't, but it depends on how we design it. If there is a rapid transition from once you get to human level machine intelligence to superintelligence, then you might have a world where at some point there is one mature superintelligence and as yet no other system that is even comparable. And that first superintelligence then can be extremely powerful for the same reasons that the human species today is extremely powerful relative to other animal species. It's not because we have stronger muscles or sharper teeth, but our brains are slightly different from those of our great ape ancestors. So that's one step in the reasoning here, that the first superintelligence could be very, very powerful. The second step is to note that for most possible final goals that this superintelligent agent might have, the organization of matter that would maximally realize that goal is one which would not leave any room for human beings or human values. To make it more concrete, let's suppose that you have an AI whose only goal is to make as many paperclips as possible.
Okay.
So now let's assume that you are this AI. So you figure, like, how can I maximize the number of paperclips that will exist in the future? So you quickly realize that one thing you don't want is to have any humans around who might decide to switch off, because if you get switched off, there will be fewer paperclips. You also realize that human bodies consist of a lot of juicy atoms that could be used to build some really nice paperclips. So you would have an instrumental reason, even if you didn't hate humans, you didn't care about humans at all, but you would have an instrumental reason in order to achieve the maximum number of paperclips to get rid of humans.
So there's going to be this constant push by these machines to gather essentially the fuel to make them go, to give them energy.
Well, to expand what there is, if you want to create maximum happiness, you want to then convert as much of the universe as possible into computers that run happy minds. If you want to calculate the digits of pi, likewise, you'd want to maximize the amount of computational hardware that exists. So with mature technology, physical resources become more or less interchangeable. There are just a few basic categories of different physical resources like time, energy, negentropy, and a few other like basic parameters like that might be relevant.
So how do you go about designing friendly superintelligent machines?
So the short answer is it's still an open problem. Broadly speaking, there are two classes of methods that one can consider here. So on the one hand, you could have capability control methods. This is when you would try to limit what the AI is able to do. So perhaps you put it in a box and you unplug the Ethernet cable. And maybe you say it will only allow it to communicate by typing text on a screen. And you hope that by clipping its wings, you sort of prevent it from being able to cause harm. I think that these kinds of capability control methods will be useful and important during the development phase of the AI, but I don't think they are the ultimate answer, basically because in order to have any kind of utility from the system, some human will have to interact with it at some point, and humans are not secure systems. Now, the other class of control method is motivation selection method. So here, instead of trying to limit what the system is able to do, you try to engineer its motivation system so that it would not want to cause harm, even though it might be able to. So you try to ensure that it has a very clear goal structure where there is a particular final goal at the top that sufficiently matches what we care about so that the AI is basically on our side.
How would you do that, though? How would you create that kind of value system for computers when it wouldn't seem at all clear that they need us?
Well, whether or not they need us depends on what they're trying to do, right? So if their goal was to serve human interests, then they would very much need us, because if they got rid of humans, they would have radically failed. The problem decomposes into two. So one is the technical problem of, if you had a particular value you had decided, how would you literally get it in there? So you might say something, oh, we want to have great human happiness, but ultimately this has to be defined in code. And so in Python or C++, there is no primitive called happiness that you can just write in your program. You actually have to define all of this. The other problem is the problem of value selection, which value to select in the first place. Considering that in this model here, this value might shape the entire future for humanity.
Yeah. Now, one question is how long all of this would take. I mean, kind of this transition from these human-level intelligent machines, basically as smart as we are, to then becoming super intelligent. And, I mean, one scenario is it might take years, decades. You suggest in your book that it might take just a few hours or a couple of days. I mean, once the machines realize that they could wipe us out.
Yes, we don't know. I mean, I think it's more likely that there will be a rapid transition. It could be minutes or hours or days or some short period of time like that. We can't be certain of that. So we also need to consider scenarios in which the transition from human level to super intelligence is much slower. If it's going to take years or decades, then it's less likely that we will have one system that is able to form a singleton and just shape the future according to its desire. More likely that there will be many different products with similar levels of capability that will undergo this transition in tandem. Then you get a multipolar outcome instead, with many different competing agencies. And the concerns in such a multipolar outcome look quite different from those in the singleton outcome that I was describing earlier. So now you would have economic competition. You would quickly have a population explosion. Humans can reproduce, but it takes like two or three decades, really, and we start out life having forgotten everything our parents learned. But AI is basically being software. We know how to copy software. It just takes a minute. So you could copy these digital minds until the wage that each digital mind is able to make is just able to pay for the hardware rental and the electricity. And so you could have trillions and trillions of these shortly after the development of human-level machine intelligence.
Now, at one point in your book, you make a chilling comparison between the fate of the horse and the possible fate of human beings. Can you explain the analogy there?
Yeah, so this pertains to the multipolar outcomes, where instead of having one agent that just shapes the future according to its desire, you now have some economy involving both digital intellects and humans. So an analogy can then be drawn to the fate of the horse, which used to have a big part in the human economy. But with the internal combustion engine and the car, the horse was sort of outcompeted by the engine. And you can then see that the horse population did not manage to, as it were, earn a subsistence wage. It no longer became economically to feed horses hay. It's cheaper to buy a car or a tractor. And you saw a collapse of the horse population by about 90%.
And so that might be our fate, the horse of
the future. Yeah, well, so if machines become better at doing all the things that we are currently doing to make a living, then it would be natural for investors to build machines instead of hiring humans.
Yeah. So just to put all of this in perspective, do you see this rise of superintelligence as something kind of remote? I mean, is this sort of a back burner kind of issue that we should start to think about? Or do you see this as really pressing?
Well, I see it as pressing to start to try to solve this control problem, because it looks really hard and we don't know how long it will take to solve it. And we also don't know exactly how long we have available before we have to have a solution. So in this situation, it would make a lot of sense to get cracking on that as vigorously as we can. I should mention as well, so there is also an upside, of course, which is literally astronomical, where if we manage to set up the initial conditions just right, then the kinds of values that could be realized, I think, are literally beyond our ability to imagine. The degree to which different outcomes are probable then depends in part on whether we get our act together sufficiently in time.
Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom is the author of Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies. Steve Paulson talked with him